The following teaching is possible thanks to the friends and partners of Spirit and Truth Fellowship International.
Well, God bless you and greetings. Welcome to this teaching, which I'm calling A Look into Ezekiel. And what I want to do in this teaching is give us a basic start into understanding the book of Ezekiel, which can be quite difficult to understand. And it certainly is difficult if we don't understand some of the background and especially the opening chapter. So I'm going to read through the chapter and I'm going to explain it as I go. Hey, I'm not going to make any excuses for this. There's a lot of detail in Ezekiel. A lot of detail. And so it requires us to really pay attention and kind of hang in there through the detail. Also, scattered through Ezekiel are a whole bunch of lessons that are important for you and I to learn and to realize that, you know, God is God. He hasn't changed. What he's teaching Ezekiel, he will teach us too. Or sometimes he teaches us by Ezekiel's example. But interestingly enough, you know, when you read the book of Ezekiel, it's not like you're reading along and then in big letters, there's a word that says lesson so that you and I know it's a lesson. We have to pay attention. We have to be in prayer. We have to be asking God, okay, God, what are you wanting me to learn from this stuff that you've put in Ezekiel? Because obviously, as with all books of the Bible, there's a lot more about Ezekiel's life than just what's in the book. So what's in the book of Ezekiel is handpicked, if you will, for you and I to read it and to understand it. So with that being said, let's talk about some of what we're going to see in these first opening chapters of Ezekiel, and then we'll talk about some of the lessons we can learn. So what are we going to see? Well, Ezekiel opens up with some biographical material about Ezekiel, and buried in that is some geographical material about Ezekiel. We're going to be looking at that because that helps us to explain what's going on. Then Ezekiel 1 has the approach of God's chariot throne to where Ezekiel is. It describes cherubim and what they're like. It describes the wheels of God's chariot throne. It describes God on his chariot throne, and it describes the glory of God and makes a separation so we can understand the difference between God and the glory of God. These are some of the things we're going to see as we get into Ezekiel chapter 1. What are some of the lessons we're going to see? Great lessons. One is, you know, you don't have to be in a great situation personally to hear from God. And that's really a great comfort. We'll talk about these lessons later. Lesson number two, we have a responsibility to speak to people about God. Lesson number three, God's a personal God. He has a relationship with you. He's invested in you. If he gives you a job, do it. Lesson number four, you know, there's profit to speaking to people even if they don't listen. So these are some of the lessons we're going to see as we get into the book of Ezekiel. I should also say that Ezekiel has more exact dating and more chronology than any other book in the Old Testament. Now, chronology is a tough subject for some people, but it's really important for us in the understanding of what God is doing in Ezekiel's heart and life. So I would ask you, if chronology is a subject that's a little difficult for you, hang in there with it, because like I say, some of the really important lessons in Ezekiel are tied to the chronology and the timing of the events in the book. So let's go ahead and let's get started reading Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the Shebar Canal, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. Verse 2. In the fifth of the month, he just said it was the fifth of the month, so it's the fifth of the month, which is the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's activity, The word of Yahweh came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the Shebar Canal, and the hand of Yahweh was on him there. Okay, that's Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 1, 2, and 3. Let's take a look at what some of this is telling us. Well, the first thing it says is, it came to pass in the 30th year. Now, since the time of Origen, the church father, this goes all the way back to the 200s AD, it has been believed, and I think properly so, that the 30th year is Ezekiel's birth year. In other words, Ezekiel is 30 years old. Okay, the Bible starts and says Ezekiel's 30 years old. Why? Well, verse 2 told us that Ezekiel was a priest. And what do we learn from the books of Moses, Numbers, and particularly Numbers chapter 4? We learn that the priests serve from 30 to 50. Now, we also see other places where they could start serving earlier. Like David said, they could start serving at 20. But it appears that what actually happened is they went into a kind of apprenticehood earlier on, but it's still the word of Moses kind of held the day, and a priest wasn't considered in full service until the time he was 30. And so Ezekiel's now turned 30. Hip, hip, hooray. He can be a priest, right? He can serve in the temple. He's been thinking about this his whole life. Wow, I get to be a priest. I get to minister to God. Oh, no, not Ezekiel. Why? Because he's a captive. He's in Babylon by the city of Nippur. He's 600 miles east of the Temple of Jerusalem, and it's not even a straight walk. You can't walk across the Arabian Desert. If Ezekiel was going to go home, he'd have to go hundreds of miles out of his way around the Fertile Crescent just to get back to Jerusalem. That's why verse 1 says that he was among the captives by the Shebar Canal, because Ezekiel was one of the captives that was taken in the Babylonian captivity. And the Shebar Canal, we learn from archaeology. You know, archaeology has really helped our understanding of the Bible. And as the various archaeological sites were excavated, then we learn more about the whole picture of the ancient Near East. And so, for example, when the city of Nippur was excavated, what was discovered was over 40,000 tablets in Sumerian and ancient Akkadian, cuneiform, all kinds of tablets on all kinds of things, and over 40,000 of them. And one of the things you find is that, whoa, we didn't really know a number of years ago what the river Shebar was. In fact, if you read most of the versions, they say River Shebar, and then you look at the area, you go, what River Shebar? There's no river there. You know, the river's the Tigris. And then you find out that the Shebar Canal was a canal system around the city of Nippur that provided water, and it was water that came from the Euphrates River. And so what do we know? We know that Ezekiel's a priest. He should be serving, but no, he can't serve because he's been taken over 600 miles east or some 600 miles east to around the Babylonian city of Nippur, which, by the way, is about 75 miles southeast of Babylon itself. Now, why is that important? Because Daniel was taken captive to Babylon probably 9 years before Ezekiel was taken captive to the area of Nippur. So we know that Ezekiel was serving around Nippur at the same time that Daniel was serving in Babylon. And by the way, at the same time that Jeremiah the prophet was prophesying and serving back in Jerusalem. So you have three active prophets at this time: Jeremiah in Jerusalem, Daniel in Babylon, Ezekiel in Nippur. But Ezekiel was a priest. And so how is he feeling about being a captive? Well, Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 14 says that he was angry and bitter about it. You know, if you're a priest, you get to be a priest, you get to serve in the temple, and he can't do it. And he wasn't real happy about it. He was disappointed. And, you know, This is an important lesson, because sometimes I think unless we feel happy, unless we feel blessed, unless we feel like, you know, we're just in a perfect position to serve God, that God won't work in us. And that's not at all true. Ezekiel was angry about his situation. He was bitter about his situation. That did not keep him from fulfilling the word of God. It did not keep God from working with him. Sometimes I think we're our own worst enemies. We cut ourselves off from the service we could give for God because we think of ourselves, oh, God would never work with a person like me. Well, yeah, God will work with anybody that's willing to work with them. You know, you got personal problems. I got personal problems. Who in the world doesn't have personal problems? Gee, we all do. You know, and if we're upset or something like that, well, you know, that's just, that's kind of just life. And we can deal with it, and God will work with us. So there's Ezekiel, and he's by the ancient city of Nippur in Babylon, and it says the hand of the Lord was upon him in verse 3, and he had visions from the Lord. So we know that Ezekiel was carried to Babylon when he would have been 26 years old, and the hand of God was upon him there. And so verse 4 then says, I looked, and behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, a great cloud with fire flashing back and forth, and a brightness all around it. And out of the center of it gleamed something like the glow of gleaming amber out of the midst of the fire. Now Ezekiel lived in Nippur, which is on a plain. And he's used to watching, you know, desert storms and thunderstorms from a distance. But this is different. What we're going to find is this is Yahweh himself coming to Ezekiel. He starts out, it looks like a storm in the distance, and it's coming right as Ezekiel, and it pulls up. We find out that it's God riding his chariot throne right up to Ezekiel. But why does he start out appearing like a storm cloud? What's the deal with the storm and the fire flashing black back and forth and that kind of thing? Well, to understand that, we have to understand some of the history of where Ezekiel was. He was by Nippur. And Nippur comes from the ancient Sumerian, and it means Lord Wind. And in Sumerian mythology, Nippur was the home of Enlil. And Enlil was the top Sumerian god. He was the storm god, and he was the creator of all mankind. He was the creator god. He was the storm god. He was top dog, top god, Enlil. And he came right out of Nippur. And he you know, would cause storms. And by the way, you know, the sanctuary at Enlil in Nippur was considered sacred by all the dynasties for a long time. And so here is Nippur, famous for Enlil, the storm god, the creator god of all mankind, and God's going to show up and say, you know, hey, I'm the real God. I'm the one you need to be worshiping, not, you know, and of course, not that Ezekiel is worshiping some storm god, but it explains why God would show up to Ezekiel in a storm, that it's really the background of the whole area. And then it says out of the center gleamed something like gleaming amber. And the gleaming amber is a rare word. It only occurs 3 times in the entire Bible, and all those 3 are in Ezekiel. One of the things you learn about Ezekiel is that Ezekiel uses a lot of difficult Hebrew words. In fact, actually a lot of words that only occur 1 time. And it makes it hard to understand exactly what Ezekiel is saying. And I don't think there's any doubt but that God did that on purpose, because God can be hard to understand. And so he uses rare words kind of to emphasize the fact that, hey, you're going to have to make an effort to get a grip on me, to really understand me. So here's this Ezekiel sitting there looking across the desert. Hey, it looks like a storm's on the horizon. Wow, that's a really strange looking storm, gleaming and flashing like that. And hey, that storm is really coming really fast. It's really localized. It's really coming right toward me. And it did. And it stopped in front of him. And it turned out to be God himself riding his chariot throne. And we're going to learn about God's chariot throne here as we continue to read Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 5. And from the midst of it, out of the storm, came what looked like four living creatures. And these guys are wild, boy. He says, this was their appearance. By the way, it says came what looked like four living creatures. Now, Ezekiel had never seen a cherubim. He had seen representations of cherubim on the temple curtains and things, but those cherubim were a little different than the real thing, just like sometimes you see an artist's rendition or something. When the real cherubim show up, and we know that they're cherubim from chapter 10, he's like, well, I don't know what these guys are, but they're living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had human form. So basically, the general outline of these cherubim was like a human being. But each one had four faces, and each one had four wings. Verse 7, their legs were straight legs, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they gleamed like burnished bronze. They had human hands under their wings on all their four sides, and the four of them had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. That tells us that these cherubim, this was not, I've seen artists' rendition of this, and the cherubim are, way far apart, and this chariot throne of God is this huge thing, looks like it takes up acres. It's not. God would have been maybe perhaps a little oversized, but not gigantic. And these cherubim may have been oversized, but not gigantic. I mean, if they were the size of an elephant, that would be okay too. But the point is, don't make them like a 10-story building. They weren't. We learn later that this chariot throne of God could park between the south side of the temple and the wall that surrounded the temple, and that area wasn't all that big. Maybe it was 50 yards, 40 yards, something like that, but it wasn't huge. And God just parked his chariot right there and got off and walked to the temple. And we see that later on in chapter 10. But the point is that this thing isn't huge like we would think of huge. So going back to verse 9, it says their wings touched one another. They were close together underneath God's throne. They did not turn when they moved. Each one went straight forward. As for the form of their faces, they each had the face of a man in front, and the four of them had a face of a lion on the right side, and the four of them had the face of an ox on the left side. The four of them also had the face of an eagle. And of course, that would then be on the backside. Verse 11, such were their faces. Their wings were spread out upward. Each creature had two wings that touched the wing of another and two wings covering its body. Each creature moved straight forward. Wherever the spirit wanted to go, they went. And that use of spirit is God. That's God who is spirit. And in places of the Bible, we know John 4:24, God is spirit. Here, God is called the spirit. And we'll see, of course, God's riding he's sitting on top of the throne, on top of the platform, which is above the cherubim. So wherever God wanted to go, that's where they went. they were God's transportation. They didn't turn when they went. Verse 13, as for the form of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches. The fire moved back and forth between the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. So if you've watched fire, it flickers and flashes and moves. Somebody said to me, well, it must have been sort of like the appearance of the aurora borealis, that it just flickers and flashes and moves and shifts. And so these they didn't have like a dead look to them. When you looked at them, they looked alive. And sure enough, the living creatures, verse 14, moved backward and forward as quick as flashes of lightning. Yeah, this is God's chariot throne drawn by his creatures. Now, these are God's created creatures, the cherubim. We look around Earth. Okay, I mentioned elephants. So God creates elephants, then he creates whales, and he creates dogs, and he creates cats, and he creates grasshoppers, and he creates all kinds of things. Well, in the spirit world, too, we learn from Ephesians about every family in heaven and earth. There's whole families of spirit beings, just like there are families of flesh beings. And we're very familiar with earth, but we don't know that much about the spirit families. But one of them is obviously cherubim. And I don't have the time in this teaching to go through and do an exhaustive study of cherubim, but basically, from what we see in the scripture, God created them and designed them to protect God and the things of God. For example, we see here in Ezekiel that these cherubim had hands. We look, go back to Genesis chapter 3, when God kicked Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden, he guarded the road with cherubim so they couldn't get back in, and those cherubim held flashing swords so these guys could be armed. And interestingly enough, as you look at these guys, the Bible never relates to them like angels. They relate to God in a totally different way. And I mean, and I don't want to overstate this, so please don't hear this wrongly, but it's just like God creates dogs sort of to be man's protector and companion and man's best friend. Well, these cherubim protect God. And when you see God, you see cherubim usually around him. Like Psalm 18 talks about God jumping on a cherub and flying. And of course, that is probably a reference to his chariot throne, like we see here. In Revelation chapter 4, when it describes God, it describes these creatures, these living creatures that are around the throne of God and between God and the other beings. And this is really important because these cherubim are, they would be terrifying creatures to see in person. Awesome and terrifying. You know, and you could see where here's Satan, and whereas Satan might be tempted to get two or three other strong of his strong fallen angel friends and try to approach God, jump God, maybe attack God. God's surrounded by these guys, and Satan's not going to mess with him. You know, you're not going to get to God through these guys. You know, these cherubim, they're going to be around God like they are in Revelation chapter 4. They're going to protect God, and not that God needs protection. I mean, God could protect himself if he wanted to, but that's never been God's intention to be so separate, so far away from his creation. You know, we talk about God being love. You know, what kind of loving God is it? God's so loving that you never see him. He never relates to you. He's so distant. You know, God wants to be near his creation. And so then he says, okay, but we're going to, there's still wisdom. You know, wisdom is still the principal thing, Proverbs 4:7. So here's the devil, and I love this. Here's the devil. So can he get to God through the cherubim? No, isn't going to try it. Forget it, isn't going to happen. So what's he do? Oh, he somehow influences demonic artists and whatever down through the ages. And what are cherubs? You know, you look up cherubs on the internet. Oh, they're little tiny babies with little tiny wings, you know, and little smiley faces. It's like, great, those are cherubs. One of the devil's tactics. Talk about a lesson. Here's a lesson from Ezekiel. One of the devil's tactics. If you can't beat them, you can at least make fun of them. And that's exactly what the devil did. He took these awesome beings that surround God, provide God transportation, protect God and the things of God. They're all over the tabernacle and the temple. Why do you think it says that both in the tabernacle and the temple, God dwells between the cherubim? The cherubim are there. They have their wings out, and God sits right in the middle of him, right in the middle of those cherubim. And so they're there to protect God and the things of God. And so the devil can't get through them, so he just makes fun of them. Now they're little tiny babies, little tiny chubby babies with wings, which is just a historic joke. So this describes these animals, and of course, all of those things. Of course, the lion, the ox, the eagle, very, very famous in Middle Eastern architecture and mythology. You know, the lion, obviously the most courageous of beasts, representing royalty. Solomon had lions on his throne. The ox, the strongest and most powerful of the domesticated animals, and also a symbol of divinity. Remember that Jeroboam, when they came out of Egypt, the children of Israel made a golden calf. Jeroboam made golden calves, and of course the eagle, the strongest, the most majestic of birds, and a human, you know, the pinnacle of God's creation. So God created these spirit beings, and they have these four faces. And is verse 15, as Ezekiel is looking at this sight, you know, the God's chariot throne approaches as this giant storm, bright, flashing light. It stops, the dust kind of clears, the cherubim become visible. It's like, oh boy, look at those guys. And then he starts to describe what else he's seeing. Verse 15, now as I looked at the living creatures, I saw one wheel on the ground beside the living creatures. In fact, one wheel for each of the four of them. That means four wheels. The appearance of the wheels and their construction sparkled like beryl. And the four of them had the same form. All four wheels looked the same. And their appearance and their construction was as if one wheel was inside another wheel. And when they moved, they went in their four directions. They did not turn when they went. And thus, what do we see? Well, the wheels are very much like the cherubim. This chariot throne of God can go in any one of the four directions. It can fly in any one of the four directions. It can roll in any one of the four directions. Verse 18, as for their rims, they were high and awe-inspiring, and the four of them had their rims full of eyes all around. And we'll take a look at that in a minute, because that's a really weird statement to us. It wasn't in the ancient Near East, but it is to us, so we need to explain it. As for their rims, they were high and awe-inspiring, and the four of them had their rims full of eyes all around. When the living creatures moved, the wheels went beside them. Well, obviously, it's a whole entity, this chariot throne. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Wherever the spirit wanted to go, they would go. Yeah, absolutely, it's God's chariot throne. He says, go there, they go. And the wheels rose up with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels, or maybe even better, in union with the wheels. It talks about the union. This was a complete vehicle, like a car. If it says the wheels go someplace, you know, so do the seats and the engine, you know, that kind of thing. When the cherubim moved, these wheels went. And when they stopped, these stopped. And when those lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up beside them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Okay, let's take a look at this word eye and see if we can get this thing understanding. Because our idea, in our English, we really just use eye. I mean, we use it a couple different ways, like the eye of a needle, and then we know that a needle doesn't actually see. But we don't use the word eye nearly as broadly as the people of the ancient Near East used the word eye. They used the word eye basically for anything that looked like an eye, or anything that gleamed or sparkled. So for example, it's interesting. I think the word eye occurs four times in Ezekiel chapter 1. In fact, actually, I think it occurs five times in Ezekiel chapter 1. You know, for example, in Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 4, and in verse 16, it's translated the word gleam, because eyes gleam. In Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 22, it's glittering, because eyes seem to glitter. If you look at Proverbs chapter 23, verse 31, it talks about the wine that sparkles in the cup. And the word sparkles is eye. That, you know, you look down the wine and it's sparkling. Well, that's like an eye, because eyes sparkle. So there's a lot of other usages. So what does it mean then when Ezekiel says that the rims were full of eyes? Well, there's we got a problem, because we don't really know what it means. But here are some possibilities. One is it could mean that it had a whole bunch of embedded gems that looked like eyes that sparkled. It could be just that the rims themselves were made in such a way that the rims just sparkled all over. That would be a possibility. Another is that the rims were put on some way with something that looked like rivets, and the rivets were shaped like eyes. That's another possibility. So there's all kinds of different ways that the rims could have eyes all around. And of course, they're not alive, they're wheels. So no, they don't see, and we need to get that right. So what have we got? We've got Ezekiel, and he's by Nippur. He's by the Shebar Canal. He's feeling angry. He's feeling bitter. He's just turned 30, and he can't fulfill his priesthood because he's 600 miles east of the temple, and he's there because of the sin of the priests and the leaders of the people who have really caused God to abandon Judah. And so the Babylonians came in and carried people away captive. And one of those captives was Ezekiel. And then God's chariot throne shows up. And who's on the chariot throne? God. And the chariot throne, we find out, is this thing that's driven by cherubim power. And it shows up. And then verse 22. And the proper understanding of verse 22 is what really puts this chapter together. Because it says, over the head of the living creatures, there was something like a platform, glittering awesomely like crystal, that was spread out over their heads above them. Oh, platform. And I got to tell you, on a personal note, it was when I really got verse 22 that all of a sudden the pieces for the rest of the chapter came together. Because, in fact, there's really only one English version that I could find that translated the Hebrew word, which is rakiva, which is normally translated firmament. Only one version I could really find, modern version, and that was the NET. And that translated it platform. Interestingly enough, in contrast, despite the fact that none of the modern versions, you know, the NIV, the New American Standard Bible, Holman Christian Standard Bible, ESV, blah de blah de blah, they all translate the word rakiva as expanse. The NET translates it platform. All of the commentaries I checked, I did not check one single commentary that didn't get that this was a platform. This is a chariot throne. This is God's chariot throne. What's under your car? Wheels. What's under God's chariot throne? Wheels. Yeah, but God's chariot throne flies. Your car doesn't fly. If your car flew, well, it would probably have wings. What's under God's chariot throne? Wings. They're on the cherubim, four wings apiece. And can they move? Remember, we just read, they move like lightning. They're lightning fast when they fly. So God's chariot throne, well, yeah, it's a chariot throne. You have a seat in your car? God has a seat on his chariot throne. What's the seat sit on? A platform. So what have we got? We've got this picture of a chariot throne. There's cherubim, which are standing there and with which it flies. It's got wheels. So if it hits the ground, it can roll. And then above the cherubim, there's this platform. And we're going to find that what's on the platform is God's throne. And what's on God's throne is God. And when we understand it was a platform, then all of a sudden, this whole picture comes together. Now, why is it translated expanse? Let's just take a quick look at the Hebrew word rakiba. Now, it's usually translated firmament, dome, or expanse. But we've got to go back and find out what the Hebrew word actually means. Now, you're all probably familiar with rakiba from Genesis 1, where it says in Genesis 1, there was a firmament in the heavens, a firmament. So let's take a look at this. Well, as rakiba started out, it basically meant to stamp with your foot. You were stomping with your foot. And then it became what was stamped. You know, you stamp out something with your foot, you flatten it out. Then it became used of plates, like metal plates that were beaten out or stamped out. So this was what the rakiba meant. It was plates that were beaten out, but they were firm plates. It wasn't empty space plates. It was a plate. It was a firm thing. So then we get to the Septuagint, give or take 250 BC. They want to translate rakiba into Greek. They translate it as stereoma. Stereoma. Okay, well then what's stereoma mean? Well, in Greek, stereoma was a solid supporting structure. And that's what it was. The Latin Vulgate comes along. How do they translate rakiba? Well, they translate it as firmamentum. The Latin word was firmamentum. And for momentum in Latin referred to something solid, which strengthens or supports, thus a firm supporting structure. That was what firmamentum meant. And of course, by the time of the King James and stuff, they just pulled firmamentum from the Latin right over into English and translated it firmament, which had the same meaning, by the way, in English as the Latin did, which was a firm structure that strengthened or supported. And if you go back and you read Genesis 1, oh, there was a firmament. And you remember that there was water above the firmament and air underneath the firmament. And the firmament was this strong supporting structure that kept the water from coming down onto the earth. And that would be the firmament. Now, what happens? So we take this word Rakiva, you read Genesis chapter 1. It doesn't make any sense that there's a firm, solid structure up there, even though there might be. We don't know what's way out beyond what our telescopes can see. Who knows? But they look up there in the modern world, and you know, we're looking 14 billion years out, or however big they say the universe is nowadays, and they say, oh, well, it can't really be a firmament. I mean, it can't be a strong supporting structure. It's got to be an expanse. And so really, without really lexical evidence, the word strong supporting structure, solid supporting structure, became expanse. But that was due to our modern understanding of the universe, not due to any kind of lexical evidence. But the important point for our understanding of Ezekiel is that Rakiba, the firmament, wasn't thought to be an expanse of air. You know, it was a hard surface that was up, that was made. And that's the way Ezekiel used it. Ezekiel used Rakiba in its original meaning of a hard supporting structure. Well, what's it supporting? It's supporting God's throne. What's between God's throne and the cherubim? This Rakiba, this hard surface. It was a platform. Absolutely. And you can understand, boy, you can, if you translate this like most versions do, if you translate this expanse, then Ezekiel becomes very hard to understand, because here's Ezekiel, he's in the desert, and these cherubim show up with these wheels beside him. Okay, that's nice. And? Well, and then there's this giant expanse, and God's up in heaven on a throne. How does this work now? Why do the cherubim need to show up with these wheels if God's way the heckin' gone up in heaven, sitting on a throne somewhere up there? That doesn't make any sense. And no wonder Ezekiel never came together for me. It wasn't until actually last month when I saw the translation platform in the NET that I was like, oh my gosh, could this really be right? And I started grabbing commentaries like mad and checking things out and checking out the history of the word firmament and seeing, holy smokes, I get what happened now in Ezekiel chapter 1. It's not that these cherubim showed up and then God's sitting way up, you know, zillions of miles up on some throne in heaven and speaking to Ezekiel. It's that these cherubim showed up, and above the cherubim was this crystalline platform, and on the crystalline platform was a sapphire blue stone, and sitting on the throne was God, and he spoke, Son of Man. And Ezekiel fell on his face. And that's what we're about to read here in Ezekiel chapter 1. So what do we see? Well, Ezekiel didn't necessarily have his emotional act together. He was bitter. He was angry. He was a priest. He turned 30 years old. He couldn't minister because of the sin of the leaders of the country, because of the sin of his fellow priests. And he's upset about it, and he's angry. And he's thinking that, what am I going to do with my life? And God shows up. I love it. God shows up. And what I learned from that is that God will show up for you and me. You know, there are times in life when you just wonder, God, what can I do? How can I serve? How can I plug in? And sometimes we're upset about our circumstances. And then sometimes we'll get down on ourselves and say, boy, if I'm upset about my circumstances, God will never show up for me, because I'm supposed to be so loving and kind and happy and joyful and just Christian, Christian, Christian. You know, that's just not life. If our heart is to serve God, there are ways to serve. There are ways to plug in. And if your heart is to serve God, God will meet you where you are. He will. Okay, well, let's keep reading. So verse 22 then, over the heads of the living creatures, there was something like a platform glittering awesomely like crystal. And again, one of the things we see here, like when it says crystal, well, crystal is one of the meanings of the Hebrew word. Another is ice. Ice is another meaning of the Hebrew word. So it's, once again, God has given us a description that if you read the original Hebrew, you'd see all the possible permutations, but we just kind of have to grab one or the other in English. But there's so many, that just it's just, we're trying to picture God and it's difficult, you know, but one thing we get from this is it's transparent. God could look down through the throne and see his cherubim. You know, and that's good. There was just this open communication between God and these wonderful creatures he created to be around him. He said it was glittering awesomely like crystal. It was spread out over their heads above them. And under the platform, their wings were stretched out straight toward one another. Each also had two wings covering its body on the one side and on the other. So you got four wings for each creature. And verse 24, you know, if you've ever been in an airport when like a really big jet is taken off, you know, verse 24, when they moved, I heard the sound of their wings like the sound of great waters, like the voice of the Almighty, like the sound of commotion, like the sound of an army. So when these guys took off, you knew it. They made a noise. And then whenever they stopped, they let down their wings. That makes perfect sense that they, you know, okay, they're done. So they let down their wings. Verse 25, then a voice came from above the platform that was over their heads. When they stopped, they let down their wings. Okay, so the voice comes from above the platform that was over their heads. Where's the voice coming from? Well, we find that it's from God. Remember, it had already told us that when the Spirit told them to move and where to move and when to move, they did. So Ezekiel here hears a voice. Doesn't say he understood what it said, but he hears the voice of God. It obviously spoke to the cherubim. They stopped. They let down their wings. Verse 26, above the platform that was over their heads was the form of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone. And we see this sapphire, the sapphire color, which also, again, the word can mean sapphire. It can mean lapis lazuli. They're both deep blue. They have different mineral qualities, but they both have approximately the same color. At least the blue sapphire does. So was it sapphire? Was it lapis lazuli? What exact color did Ezekiel see? We can't really get a grip on it, but we have an idea, this deep blue that he saw, the appearance of a sapphire stone. And on the form of the throne, high up, was the form like the form of a man. And we see that this is Yahweh. Now, I know that the Bible says that no man has seen God at any time. Spirit and Truth Fellowship has a lot of material on that. When you see the form of God that he takes on to interact with his creation, that is not all there is to God. Just because you've seen the human form that God sometimes takes on doesn't mean you've seen all of God. We have a lot of material on this, and I would direct you to, for example, the commentary entry, the REV commentary entry on Genesis chapter 18, when Yahweh shows up and talks to Abraham. But God does show up through the Bible in a number of times in the form of a man. God showed up to Abraham, well, Adam that way, Abraham that way in Genesis 18 and in other places as well. The elders of Israel in Exodus chapter 24. Of course, to Jacob too, the Jacob's ladder and Yahweh standing at the top. 1 Samuel chapter 3, when God showed up to Samuel. God showed up to Solomon a couple times. We see it in Daniel chapter 7. We see it in Isaiah chapter 6. We see it in Acts chapter 7 when God showed up to Stephen. So there's a number of places, and again, I refer you to the REV commentary. So he says, wow, there's this throne. It's really blue, and it's got a form like the form of a man. Verse 27, now you got to describe God. Talk about difficult? Let's try and describe God. Verse 27, and I saw from the appearance of his waist and upward what looked like gleaming amber. And again, this word only occurs three times, all in Ezekiel, and we're not really sure what it means. Gleaming amber is a good stab taken by a number of the scholars. Some scholars say electrum. Some scholars say some other things, but gleaming amber is a good stab. Waist and upward, what looked like gleaming amber, with like the appearance of fire enclosing it all around. And from the appearance of his waist and downward, I saw what looked like fire. And there was a brightness all around him, like the appearance of a rainbow that's in the cloud in the day of rain. So was the appearance of the brightness all around him. This was the appearance of the form of the glory of Yahweh. When I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard a voice of one that spoke. Now, let's go back and pick this apart a little bit, because we're going to do, one thing we're going to do is we want to separate Yahweh himself from the brightness around Yahweh, which is called the glory of Yahweh, because you have Yahweh in his personal form, if you will, and then you have the bright cloud, the cloud of brightness that surrounds him, and that's called the glory of Yahweh. And so basically, as we look at Yahweh, again, like the cherubim, when it says he had the appearance of fire enclosing it all around, that's hard for us to grasp. But if we think about fire flashing and flickering and moving and changing colors, now it's yellow, now it's orange, now there's red, now there's a hint of blue, sometimes there's even a hint of green. You know, when you think about fire, you're looking at God. He's not just like this dead flesh color. He's alive, he's vital, he's the source of life itself. You know, the words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life, and the Spirit of God has life. And when you look at him, he has life, just even in his body, even in the way he looks, there's motion, there's change right in him. And that's the description of God. And then the verse goes on to say, and there was brightness all around him like the appearance of the rainbow that's in the cloud in the day of rain. Now, this has caused some artists to draw God, and he's sitting on the throne, and he's got a rainbow around him like a little circle or a little rainbow shape. And that's not really what the picture is. It says, like the appearance of a rainbow. There was brightness like the appearance. The brightness was like the appearance of a rainbow. Well, what does that mean? It's all these colors that are intermixed. And so was the appearance of the brightness. And then we see the rainbow colors again when John sees the picture of God sitting on the throne, surrounded by his cherubim, in Revelation chapter 4. In Revelation chapter 4, we again see the throne of God, God sitting on the throne, and we see the colors of the rainbow around God. God loves colors. Take a look at the world around us. God loves colors. He loves what colors do and how wonderful they make life. God could have made everything gray. I mean, we'd still be alive, you know, you'd still eat and stuff. But I mean, all your clothes would be gray. Everything you ate would be gray. Everything you looked at would be gray. Would you be alive? Yeah. Does it necessarily sound like fun? No. You know, God just, he's so alive, and he just surrounds himself with this bright cloud of colors. It's just fantastic. And we need to pay attention here, close attention, to the fact that Ezekiel is making a distinction between God and how it describes him and the brightness around God and the appearance of the brightness. And then it says, after describing the appearance of the brightness, that all the colors of the rainbow, it says, this was the appearance of the form of the glory of Yahweh. So the glory of Yahweh and Yahweh are two different things. And if we're going to understand the Bible, we need to understand this. So I'm going to take just a second here to try and talk about the glory of Yahweh versus Yahweh. Starting about this, you know, the word glory has a lot of meanings. It can refer to things like honor or praise. But there are times, and you can tell these times from the context, when the glory of Yahweh refers to the bright cloud that surrounds Yahweh. And then God is in the center of the glory. The reason the glory is there is because God is there. It's not like the glory is like a little ball of light that God moved from one place to another. The glory of Yahweh is the bright light, the bright cloud, if you will, that surrounds Yahweh and you know, is this glory that people can see. Now, there are times Yahweh appears to people, like in Genesis 18:1, when God appeared to Abraham, that he doesn't have his glory. There are times when God appears like he did in Ezekiel, when he's got his glory and he lets people see through the glory and see Yahweh himself. And sometimes Yahweh appears as this brilliant light and people don't see Yahweh inside it. They just see the brilliant light. Absolutely. I think of, for example, when Moses made the tabernacle and set up the tabernacle, the tent of meeting in Exodus chapter 40. It talks about the glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle and nobody was able to minister there. Same thing happened when Solomon dedicated the temple and the glory of Yahweh filled the temple and the priests couldn't minister. Why had the glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle? Why had the glory of Yahweh filled the temple? Because Yahweh went there, he dwelled there, he lived between the cherubim. That's where he was, and where Yahweh was, his glory shone. Absolutely. That's also why Timothy, you remember, Timothy is going to tell us that God dwells in inapproachable light. That's in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Verse 16, that God lives in inapproachable light. Where did Timothy get that? Why would anybody believe that? Because that's what the Old Testament said. You know, when Stephen was being stoned, he looks up. What does Stephen say in Acts chapter 7? He looks up, he says, I see the glory of God and Jesus standing on the right hand of God. Now that's what he saw. He said, I see the glory of God and Jesus standing on the right hand of God. That's what he saw. But then how does he describe it? He says, I see the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God. How did he know it was God? Because if he saw the glory, then he knew God was in it. Absolutely. You know, when God shows up in his glory at very interesting times, at the birth of his Son, Jesus Christ, I love this. You know, I think about the birth of my son and how proud I was and how I was excited to be there. You know, and here's the birth of his son, Jesus Christ, and it says, the glory of the Lord shone around about the shepherds, and they were very frightened. Well, yeah, why would the glory of the Lord show up? Because God showed up. Now, they didn't see God, but just God is there announcing the birth of his son. Absolutely. Same thing when it's a transfiguration. You know, the Peter, James, and John are up there on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus Christ. And, you know, and all of a sudden it says this cloud of glory surrounded them and this voice spoke up. What's happening? God is showing up. Absolutely. Yeah, we're talking about the death of his son. Is God going to be there and be supportive? You bet he is through every bit of that trial and tribulation. So God shows up for his son just like he'll show up for us. Absolutely. So now we can understand, see, why Ezekiel would describe God and then describe this brightness around God and call that the glory of Yahweh. So how does Ezekiel, I can just see Ezekiel, you know, when he first sees the storm cloud, it's like, what's going on? I'm not getting this. What's happening here? And then he sees the cherubim, and he doesn't even know what they are. He calls them living creatures. And then he sees the platform. Then he sees the throne. Then he sees God on the throne, and he gets what's going on and all of the glory. And he says the very last phrase in Ezekiel chapter 1, when I saw it, I fell on my face. Yeah, no kidding. You and I do the same thing. And I heard a voice of one that spoke. And I wish Ezekiel chapter 2 had, I wish it wasn't a chapter because, see, it would be much easier for us to see what happened if there wasn't a chapter break there. Because, you know, God's calling out Ezekiel, this disappointed, angry young priest who's ready to work for God but is angry that he can't serve. And God says, I'm going to bring this man into my service. And he comes zooming over in his chariot throne and he parks it in front of Ezekiel. And when Ezekiel recognizes what it is and there's God on the throne, he falls on his face. And chapter 2, verse 1, he, God, said to me, son of man, stand up on your feet and I will speak with you. Exactly. See, God here is going to treat Ezekiel, you know, gosh, lessons. God wants to deal with us mano a mano. You know, God doesn't want us as some supplicant that, oh, yes, God, whatever you say. You know, get some fire in us. Get some strength in our bones. Ezekiel, I'm gonna call you out to do a tough mission. You think you and I haven't been called out to be a tough mission? How many people have you witnessed to recently? How they responded? We've got a tough mission, too. We're ambassadors for Christ. We've been given the word of reconciliation. We've been committed the ministry of reconciliation. We're supposed to help win people for Christ. You think it's easy? It's not. You know it's not. I know it's not. Gosh. You know, and God knows that we're going to need some fire in us and some strength in our bones. He says to Ezekiel, "Son of man, stand on your feet and I will speak with you." And when he spoke to me, I like this, he didn't even wait for Ezekiel to get up. The Spirit entered me and set me on my feet. And then I heard him who spoke to me. And listen to what God says here. So powerful. He says, "Son of man, I'm sending you to the children of Israel, to a nation of rebels who've rebelled against me." And look at the honesty of God there. He's not saying, oh, these people that I just love and they're wonderful and whatever. Does God love them? Yes. Are they rebels? Absolutely. Is God honest about it? Yes, he is. He goes on, "They and their fathers have transgressed against me even to this day. The children are impudent and stiff-hearted. I'm sending you to them and you must tell them." So he's telling Ezekiel what he has to say. And then he goes on, he says, verse 6, "You son of man, don't be afraid of them, nor afraid of their words, though briars and thorns are with you when you sit on scorpions." In other words, these guys are going to be tough to deal with. "Don't be afraid of their words, nor dismayed at their looks, for their rebellious house. You're to speak my words to them." Watch this. "You are to speak my words to them." This is verse 7, chapter 2, verse 7. "You are to speak my words to them, whether they will hear or whether they will refuse to hear, for they are most rebellious." Lesson. It's important that you and I speak God's word. How people respond is not important. If we speak God's word with love, remember Ephesians 4:15, speaking the truth in love. But if we speak God's word with love, even if people don't respond, there are things happening in the spiritual world. Absolutely. And he says, "I want you to speak my words, whether they will hear or whether they refuse to hear. But you, son of man, hear what I tell you. Don't be rebellious. Open your mouth and eat what I give you." And then God gives him a scroll. And then in chapter 3, he said to me, again, we have to be sensitive to the fact that these chapters don't define what's the breaks in the narrative, that God continues to speak. He said, "Son of man, eat what you find." And we need to pay attention here. We want a lesson. Listen to how often God said, "Speak, speak, speak." In chapter 2, he said, "You must tell them." In verse 4, he said, "You are to speak my words to them." In verse 7, now in verse 1, he says, "Go speak to the house of Israel." Verse 4, he says, "Son of man, go to the house of Israel and speak my words." And then he goes on and he says to Ezekiel, look, verse 8, "I've made your face hard against their faces, your forehead hard against their forehead. I've made your forehead like stone harder than flint." What's this mean to you and me? That sometimes we have to be hard-headed so that we push on through the rejection. You know, you speak to one person, you get rejected. You speak to another, you get rejected. After you do that for a while, you can lose your fire. You can lose your enthusiasm. We need to be hard-headed for God. I don't know a better way to say it. We just need to be hard-headed for God so that we can continue to do what he wants us to do, even when people are not responsive. And then he says, verse 11, "And go to the exiles, to the children of your people, and speak to them." So he says it again, speak. "Whether they will hear, whether they refuse, say to them." Absolutely. And so God now has said, speak, 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 speak. Is it pretty clear what Ezekiel's supposed to do? Should be. Verse 12, then what happened? "Then the Spirit lifted me up, and I heard behind me the sound of a great rumbling." Remember the cherubim and the noise they makes? "The sound of a great rumbling as the glory of the Lord rose from its place." God and his chariot throne are lifting off. God is moving. He and his cherubim, And there they go, like a big old 737. I heard the noise of the wings of the living creatures as they touched one another, and the noise of the wheels beside them, even the noise of a great rushing. So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness in the heat of my spirit, and the hand of Yahweh was strong on me, meaning I had strong revelation. Verse 15, then I came to them of the captivity at Tel Aviv. Now, that's not Tel Aviv, Israel. That's Tel Aviv, Babylon, by the Shebar Canal. So he says, I came to them of the captivity at Tel Aviv that lived by the Shebar Canal and to where they lived. And now, what did God say to do? Speak, 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 speak. Was Israel impressed? I mean, was Ezekiel impressed with God? He was blown away. He was flat on his face. So what should Ezekiel have done? Speak, 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 speak. But what happened? Probably, frankly, I can see this happening to me. I mean, you know, you see this unbelievable, this thing from God. He shows up personally in his chariot throne, talks to you, calls you out as a prophet, gives you a mission, and then he takes off and puts you by the people you're supposed to speak to. And do you speak? No, Ezekiel. You know, again, so human, so personal lesson. You know, God puts up with personal failures. God couldn't have said, speak more clearly. He couldn't have called Ezekiel out as a prophet more clearly. He couldn't have made it more clear to Ezekiel that I, Yahweh, am calling you out personally to a mission. I've showed up personally in my chariot throne to give you this mission, to go speak. So he transports Ezekiel to those at Tel Aviv that live by the Shebar Canal, to where they lived. And how does chapter 3, verse 15 end? And I sat there overwhelmed among them 7 days. So what's Ezekiel do? Does he speak? No! He's so blown away, he doesn't speak. He just sits there overwhelmed. Meanwhile, here's God up in heaven. He's pacing back and forth. What's that guy doing down there? When's he going to get going? What's happening anyway? Verse 16. It came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of Yahweh came to me. Basically, after 7 days, God said, okay, that's as long as I'm waiting. God became impatient. Interesting. We've got a personal God. He needs our help. It says in Corinthians that we're fellow workers with God. He needs our help. He's made us ambassadors. He's not taking that back. He gave us the word of reconciliation. He's not taking that back. He gave us the ministry of reconciliation. He's not taking that back. He's waiting for us. Here he's waiting for Ezekiel. He waits 7 days. Finally, it's like, I got to go down there and talk to that boy, see if I can get him going. So in verse 17, after waiting 7 days, he shows up. Verse 17, son of man, I've made you a watchman to the house of Israel. Therefore, hear the word from my mouth and give them warning from me. When I tell the wicked, you will surely die, and you give him no warning. And then God goes on and gives a special revelation to Ezekiel. And then there's more, of course. But there's so much here. I you know, I'll let you finish Ezekiel chapter 3 and frankly the rest of Ezekiel. I think we've gotten a good start. But what are some of the lessons? Well, one is you don't have to be in a good situation personally or spiritually to hear from God. If your heart is to serve God, then God will work with you. And there's a lot of different ways to serve. There's a lesson that as ambassadors for Christ and as children of God, we have a responsibility to speak to people about God. Ezekiel was personally called out to do it. We were called out as the children of God to do it. There's a lesson about the fact that God's a personal God, and if he gives you a job, he's invested in you, and he wants you to do it. I love God got impatient with Ezekiel. What's he doing down there? It's been 7 days. He's not speaking. Well, God's made us fellow workers with him. So we need to get to work. We need to get about his work. Absolutely. And I love the lesson that there's a profit in speaking to people, even if they won't listen. You know, don't let people get you down. Really. Don't let people get you down. You know, people don't listen. People don't obey. People don't care. People don't do a lot of things. Don't let that stop you. You and I make waves in the spiritual world when we obey God, even if we don't see any effect of our efforts here on earth. The very fact we're obeying God is huge in the spiritual world and makes waves. Well, in wrapping up, let me say that in really putting Ezekiel chapter 1 together and understanding where Ezekiel was and what the situation was really gave me a jump start in seeing what was going on for the rest of the book. Well, Ezekiel 1 was confusing. You just never felt like you had your feet on the ground in the book. But it makes a tremendous difference. And there's many, many other great lessons in Ezekiel, and I'm sure we'll be seeing some of those in the days and weeks ahead. And God bless you, and thank you for taking the time to listen to this teaching.